I was talking to people in my house group on Wednesday, and I said what I was preaching on. And I won't say who, but one of them responded, "Ah, the dull gifts." So this evening I'm going to be preaching on the dull gifts. In case you're not clear which ones the dull gifts are, it's administration, helping, hospitality and giving. I've only been given 4 verses to preach on, so I don't want to use them all at once. So I will come on to them as we get to the relevant gift. But I wanted to start with a little bit of context. The greatest commandment is to love God with everything we've got. The second greatest commandment is to love our neighbour as ourself. The Great Commission is to go and make disciples of all nations. And the chief end of man, in the shorter Westminster Catechism, is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. And I think spiritual gifts need to be seen in that context, because that is the headline of what we're here to do. So, spiritual gifts, and more specifically, administration, helping, hospitality, and giving. They need to be viewed in that context. We need to be seeking to serve God's purposes for God's glory by loving God and our neighbour. Spiritual gifts are tools for that job. So, 4 verses. The first one is 1 Peter 4:9-10, but I'm only going to read verse 10 at this point in time because I am saving them. Each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms. And I've also added a few bonus verses. So 1 Corinthians 12:7. Now to each one, the manifestation of the Spirit is given for the common good. So there's a few points to make following on from that. The first is that they are gifts. We don't get to pick. We all get at least one. We have a priesthood of all believers. So all believers have at least one spiritual gift. They are manifestations of the Spirit, of the Holy Spirit. But let's not get hung up on the fact that the gifts that we're looking at tonight are not obviously spiritual. There are ones like tongues, which are obviously spiritual. And then these ones, there are plenty of non-Christians who are very good at these 4 things. But perhaps more importantly, they're for the common good. They're not for personal gain or benefit. They're not for our egos to make us feel good about ourselves or to gain a personal reputation. And if we don't use our gifts, everyone loses out. So, I'm going to start with helping. 1 Corinthians 12:28 says, "And in the church, God has appointed, first of all apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then workers of miracles, also those having gifts of healing, those able to help others." So, helping is a spiritual gift recognised by Paul and set out in the Bible. And Romans 12:7 says, "If it is serving, let him serve." So if your spiritual gift is serving, use it. As I was preparing for this, I thought about a tea towel. When I was at university, we had a number of tea towels, but it's only one specific tea towel I'm going to tell you about. You might be glad to know. But this tea towel had a message, and I had to Google to find the message, but it was this. "There was an important job to be done, and everybody was sure that somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry about that because it was everybody's job. Everybody thought anybody could do it, but nobody realised that everybody wouldn't do it. It ended up that everybody blamed somebody when nobody did what anybody could have done." And I think that sums up helping quite well. Because a lot of the gifts of helping are things that anybody could have done. But the fact is that there's people with the gifts of helps, or people exercising that gift even though it's not their particular gift. They're doing something which needs to be done and which is helping others. We are commanded to serve one another. In Galatians chapter 5, verse 13, it says, serve one another in love. But people with the gift of helps are often responding to a need. So we see that in the Bible, where Jesus washed the disciples' feet. We also see it in Mark chapter 15, verse 41. It mentions that there were a number of women who followed Jesus around and ministered to his needs. There are a number of other examples, and I'm sure that you can think of tons of examples from your personal life and experience, where people have stepped in either to help you personally or to help the church. Over the course of this weekend, I have read most of this book on Church, No Spectator Sport, In Search of Spiritual Gifts by Eric Wright. He was a missionary in Pakistan for a number of years and then ministered at a church in the States for a period after that, and he's now an itinerant minister. And he's looking at spiritual gifts. He splits them into various types of gifts, but there's a section on the serving gifts. So a lot of what I'm going to say this evening draws on what Eric Wright, a man with many more years' experience and theological training, has thought. So one of the things that he does is he brings in definitions of various gifts. And he says that the gift of helps is a spirit-produced helpfulness characterised by the readiness to serve wherever there is a need, the ability to notice things that need to be done, the training or talents to meet practical needs, and a humble attitude of happy servanthood. So people with this gift notice needs that others overlook. And they get stuck in to care for practical needs without lots of fuss and without much ado. And I'm sure that you can all think of a number of people who've got that gift in South Parade. So this gift, it can free others with more specialised gifts so they can fulfil their role. It can be used to enable us to grow personally and spiritually. It might include food preparation, finance, building maintenance, grass cutting, stacking chairs, giving someone a lift, taking meals around to someone after they've had a baby, doing someone's laundry. You name it. It could be anything. And each person who's got this gift will probably express it slightly differently. If you're good with your hands, good with woodwork, you might do something of that nature. If you're better at cooking, you might do something of that nature. But it's a willingness to get stuck in and do what you can do to help other people. And I think that people with this gift are the unsung heroes. And that's why I've started with them, because I think they deserve some credit. Helping does not come with an office or a job title, but these people make such a difference. If you took away the helpers, church would be so different. Would we have chairs? Would we have the PA? Would there be a notice sheet? Would the screen be there? Would the bills be paid? Would the electricity be working? Would it have been cut off? You know, there's so many things that people can do. And in this book, Eric Wright talks about how do we become more helpful. And I think this section is probably aimed at those for whom this is not their gift. But we can look around for things to do. We can look beyond the immediate needs to future needs. So it might be that if someone's become ill, loads of people rally around initially, but what happens a month down the line when there are presumably still some needs there? We can learn to listen between the lines. If someone keeps telling you they're okay, maybe they're not. And we can offer concrete help rather than just general concern. I've been given four gifts to talk about. One could probably spend an entire sermon on each one of them. Unfortunately, we don't have time to do that, so I'm now moving on to the next gift. Hospitality. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 9 says, offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. And Mr. Wright defines this as the gift of hospitality is that spirit-produced commitment of home and resources to provide a warm and loving atmosphere of acceptance in which all kinds of people are made to feel at home. He doesn't say this, but although my view is that although we associate hospitality with the home, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be the home. You could be welcoming people into the church. You could be making them feel at home right here. You could be offering hospitality in somebody else's home. You could be welcoming somebody there, helping them to find their feet, perhaps when they've just arrived in the country or just arrived at the church. And then he goes on to say there's a difference between hospitality and entertainment. So hospitality is the biblical concept, entertainment. He talks about entertaining friends and family. I don't like his distinction. To my mind, it's about the motivation. Are you offering hospitality to bless people and to love them? Or are you doing it for personal reasons, such as, well, I suppose we better have them over because they had us over. If you're doing it for that, it might not fall within the concept of hospitality, but I think it's quite wide. So the Greek word is apparently philoxenia, love of strangers. And that's a really obvious sense of hospitality, that you're opening your home to people that you don't know to offer food, friendship or accommodation. So that might be refugees or asylum seekers. We obviously have people from the council in recently. It might be hosting those on mission or furlough, those returning from mission, or having international students over, or single people or people who've just had a relationship breakdown, or it might be fostering, or it might be taking in somebody not in a formal fostering relationship, but somebody's having a tough time at home. It might be welcoming new people to church, or providing a safe space for those who are burdened. I know that a number of people here have looked after people when they've been sick, seriously sick. They've had them into their homes, they've provided them with a bed, they've provided them with food, they've looked after them. And that's hospitality. But it's also hospitality to have someone over for a short cup of coffee and a chat. So hospitality, it helps people to get to know one another better. It can provide a safe space for people. It provides an opportunity for the sorts of conversations that we don't have at church on a Sunday. It can provide a warm atmosphere of acceptance, and who doesn't need that? And it's also a key quality for church leaders, if you look at 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, and Titus chapter 1, verse 8. And in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 10, hospitality is one of the things expected of widows if they're wanting help from the church. There can be all sorts of fears which stop us from offering hospitality. My house is a mess. My house isn't big enough. I don't have enough seating. My housemates or non-Christian spouse or children or parents won't like it. I don't know what we'll talk about. Maybe they'll be bored. My cooking's not great. I can't afford it. I don't have the time. What if they outstay their welcome or take advantage of me? What if they break stuff? It's a bit of an invasion of my privacy, really, isn't it? There are all sorts of reasons, and it might be that you can think of others, other fears in relation to having people over. But often, for a lonely person or someone who's just moved to the area, they're glad to have someone to talk with. They're not expecting a gourmet, five-star meal. They're probably just glad that someone else is doing the cooking and that there is some food. You could just have them in for a cup of tea or a bowl of soup. It doesn't have to be fancy. And if you're worried about people outstaying their welcome, you could set an end time by having somewhere else to go at a certain time in the afternoon. The council was talking about, in the context of what might be regarded as more onerous hospitality, so having sort of teenage boys from other countries come to stay, it was talking about sharing it. So you could offer hospitality and you don't have to do it on your own, you could get other people involved as well. You could host a small group, or you could welcome people at church, for example at the student lunch. Some of these fears will be very real, and some of them there's ways around. But all the more reason to be grateful for those people who are very hospitable. Because I think about when I first came to South Parade, some people in particular invited me to their house a number of times, and that helped me to settle in and feel welcome and feel a part of the furniture. And I suppose the flip side of all this is having put ourselves in the shoes of the host and seen the whole list of fears, that we ought to try to be thoughtful guests. In the book, Eric Wright talks about how when they were in Pakistan, there would be people who would come and they'd stay with Christians either at mission houses or in their own homes, in a kind of, oh, they'll be so glad to see us kind of way, in order to save themselves money. And obviously sometimes that might be perfectly legitimate, but he was saying that quite often these people didn't perhaps realise that there was a cost to the host of both time and money, and that there was a real fine line of trying not to take advantage of those hosts, particularly in cultures where hospitality is a really important duty. Administration. Administration's a funny one because it's quite wide in many senses. It can be called administration, it can also be called leadership. And there's no overlap between the two. You can probably be an administrator without being a leader, and a leader without being an administrator, but there are definite overlaps. And I'm incorporating the two together. So 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 28. We've already read part of this verse, so I'm not going to read the entire thing, but God has appointed, dot, 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 those with gifts of administration. So again, God appoints. Romans 12, verse 8. If it is leadership, let him govern diligently. So leaders are to be diligent. Administrators are to be diligent. It is a gift which is both shunned and coveted. What do I mean by that? I mean that some who are gifted in this area flee the responsibility. Others desire the position and yet lack the skills. There are two aspects to it, according to Eric Wright, but I think it's a reasonable analysis. Firstly is the skill in assessing the current situation in order to formulate a plan. So where are we now? The second bit is the ability to inspire and lead others in the accomplishment of that plan. Where are we trying to get to? How are we going to get there? So the present and the future. Reluctant leaders are in good company. Moses springs to mind, but there are many others. And as I was reading this book, I thought he had quite an interesting analysis. He was looking at Nehemiah about what leaders, what administrators do. And I thought it was quite a helpful analysis, so I'm proposing to run through it. So what do? You prepare. Firstly, you've got to check your motivation. Is your motivation to glorify God, or is it some kind of personal pet, hobby horse, or ego trip? You need to clarify your vision. What is it? Where are we trying to get to? What's the goal? You need to evaluate the situation. Where are we now? And you need to formulate a plan. How do we get from where we are now to where we want to be? That's the preparation stage. You're probably doing that on your own, or possibly with the other leaders, but that's the preparation stage. Next stage, presentation. Motivation. You need to motivate the people. You need to take the people with you. You need to take the church with you. The church is a voluntary organisation. If people aren't with you, they're not going to follow. You can't compel them. You can compel a very small number. You can compel the employees, but you can't compel the rest of the people, so you have to take them with you. And you need to organise the task. So you need to break it down. How are we going to achieve this? And Nehemiah, he had a simple organisational plan, and he worked within natural affiliations. So he had families working together, and he had them working near their homes as they built the wall. Which bit of wall are you going to be most bothered about? Probably the one that's closest to your property, because it's a defensive wall. So of all bits of wall, that's the one you really want to hold, isn't it? And then he moved into action. They started building the wall, and they had to complete the task. There are various types of administrator and leader, and every administrator or leader will lead slightly differently, depending on their personality types and exact nature of their gifting. Some are behind the scenes, some are more up front. I think that 1 Timothy 3 is relevant here. It looks at the qualities expected of overseers and deacons. We need to be careful not to confuse the gifting with the office or the job title, but deacons, the first deacons, were to serve. There were seven men chosen to wait on tables because of a suggestion that the Greek the Greek people in poverty weren't being looked after properly. So they were there to serve in a practical way. And leadership can be a lonely place. Nehemiah had to deal with discouraged people, external threats, internal injustices, and a seemingly impossible task. But leadership and administration is not about trying to do everything yourself. It's about equipping and releasing others as well, so that they can do what needs to be done. And giving. Romans chapter 12, verse 8. If it is contributing to the needs of others, let him give generously. And there's a lot that wouldn't happen here without giving. The building wouldn't be maintained, it would probably have to be sold. There'd be no staff, no notice sheets, and a number of ministries, including our involvement in CAP, would need to be stopped. I'm sure that Charles could probably tell me a whole lot of other things that we wouldn't be able to do. The definition of this is the spirit endowed ability to view financial or material resources on trust or as a trust from God and to handle them according to wise principles of stewardship in order to have the wherewithal to respond to need with humility and liberality. You don't have to be rich to have this gift, if you remember the poor widow. 1 Timothy 5:16 talks about people looking after their own family. So it may be in a particular scenario people need to support family. We should all be giving, and that applies to many of the gifts. We should all be doing them to some degree. But I will leave others on other sermons to talk about how much and whether that is post-tax or pre-tax, and what people who are in debt should do, and a whole load of other minefields. I'm going to leave that to somebody else. Biblical examples of those with the gift of generosity include many who sold their possessions in the early church, and people in poor churches who sought to help those in Jerusalem during the famine. So I'm thinking of Macedonia, for example. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 to 5. It doesn't have to be money. It can be material goods that people give to others. And I suppose an example of that might be that, I'm not sure if it's Mary or just another woman who has no name, but who anointed Jesus' feet with perfume, a very expensive perfume, like probably the most precious thing that she owned. So that's a very generous gift. And as I was preparing this, I thought, money is one of the idols of our age. And I think, you know, it can be very hard to give money away. And one of the things that Eric Wright talks about in this book is that almost all Westerners are wealthy by global and historical standards. And that we should all ask God whether this is our gift or one of them. Because disobedience in this area can affect our effectiveness elsewhere. And I think that's incredibly challenging. So characteristics of a generous giver. A sense of personal involvement. So not just giving out of guilt, not just giving to get a tax deductible receipt, if that applies, but giving because you own the project in some way, or giving because you know the people who it's helping. A sensitivity to the material needs of others. Pride keeps most people from mentioning their needs, but people who are sensitive will pick up the subtle hints. An acute sense of personal accountability. The parable of talents talks about people being responsible for what they do with their talent. Regular giving, not just responding to emotional reaction. Generosity. Giving without a hidden agenda, so not aiming to manipulate or control others or acquire prestige, but giving for love, with no thought of reward or thanks, with the only motive being to help those who need help. And privacy. In Matthew 6, verses 2 to 4, Jesus told us to give in secret. So that is a whistle-stop tour of the four gifts. If anyone would like to borrow Church No Spectator Sports in search of spiritual gifts, you'd be very welcome. Do just come and speak to me afterwards. So general comments to conclude. all the gifts are essential, and we can all display all the gifts to a greater or lesser extent. Sometimes we might be called to do things even though they're not our particular gift. It's okay to say no sometimes. You don't need a formal office or title to exercise your gifts. Thinking outside the box is allowed. For example, hospitality doesn't have to be in your own home. Giving doesn't have to be money. It could be some other kind of material resource. There are various barriers to exercising gifts, such as fear, discouragement, idols, not wanting to commit, busyness. And we all need to work out whether reasons that are stopping us from exercising gifts are genuine issues or whether they're excuses. Motives matter. It's interesting that in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 12 deals with spiritual gifts. 1 Corinthians 13 is about love. And now I will show you the most excellent way. And he says that without love, we are nothing, we have nothing. We're just a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. It doesn't matter how gifted you are. If you're doing it without love, it's pointless. We're accountable for how we use our gifts. That's seen in various parables, the parable of the virgins, the parable of talents, the parable of the sheep and the goats. Sensitivity is required with all of the gifts, and we need to be careful that when we're serving, we're doing it for the right reasons, that we're not serving or giving or whatever it is out of guilt or because I'd rather do that than. And I think to conclude, we need to encourage people with these gifts. They are fantastic gifts. They are a wonderful offering to the church. They're such a fantastic contribution. We could not function without them. And I mean that quite literally. And yet I think because these gifts are not in the limelight, I think that they're often overlooked and often underappreciated. That the kind of gifts that you perhaps don't notice when they're being done, but you notice the absence. So I would really encourage you all, if you see people with these gifts, if you see people exercising these ministries, encourage them. Let them know that what they're doing is appreciated and valued. So there we go. Practical expressions of God's love.